Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we are tackling something absolutely core to how multinational companies work, but often feels pretty complex. Pricing intra-group services, or IGS.
Exactly. That's basically when different parts of the same corporate group, like a parent company and its subsidiaries, provide services to each other.
And these aren't trivial things, are they?
Not at all. It covers a huge range. We're talking technical support for manufacturing, maybe sales and marketing help, strategic management advice, and of course, all the crucial back office stuff, HR, accounting, IT, finance, you name it.
Okay, so the big issue isn't just doing the service, it's figuring out the price for it. The sources we looked at, especially focusing on guidelines from major Asian economic hubs, are really clear on this.
Yeah, the price has to satisfy tax authorities globally. It needs to be arm's length, basically, commercially justifiable.
So our mission today is pretty focused. What actually makes a service something you can charge for? What's the basic formula for the price, the cost, plus the markup? And then what are the main ways companies actually handle the billing internally? Because apparently some methods are way riskier than others.
That's the plan, breaking it down step by step.
Great. So let's start right at the beginning. How do we even know if, say, some advice given over a Zoom call or an internal report is something subsidiary A should actually pay parent co for?
It all comes down to one core idea. Does the service have commercial or economic value for the entity receiving it?
Okay, value. But how do you measure that? Is there a specific test?
There's essentially a two-part test. First, you ask, if the parent company hadn't done this, would the subsidiary have needed to do it itself? Or maybe pay someone else to do it.
Makes sense. And the second part?
The second question is, would an independent company just operating in the market realistically pay another unrelated company for that same activity?
Ah, so it's about whether a third party would see value in it too.
Exactly. If the answer to either of those is yes, then you've likely got a service that needs to be priced and charged.
And it doesn't matter if it was a physical visit or just remote support, right?
Right.
Our sources stressed that.
Correct. The delivery method is kind of irrelevant. It's purely about the economic benefit received by the subsidiary.
So if that's the test for including something, what activities absolutely must be kept out of the cost base because they fail this value test? This seems like a key risk area.
It absolutely is. There are two main categories you have to exclude, and they are high risk if you get them wrong. First up, shareholder activities.
Meaning?
These are things the parent company does purely because it owns the subsidiary. Think about the costs of preparing the group's consolidated financial statements or general corporate governance tasks that benefit the shareholders or the group structure itself, not the subsidiary's specific operations.
Okay. But couldn't you argue that high-level management guidance sort of blends governance with operational advice? Is it always easy to separate?
That's the tricky part, and exactly why tax authorities look closely. It's not always simple. If the group CEO is reviewing the overall group debt structure, that's likely shareholder activity.
Right.
But if that same CEO spends time directly advising subsidiary A on, say, launching a new product line specifically in their local market, well, that looks much more like a chargeable operational service.
So documentation becomes key there to show the specific benefit.
Crucial. And the second major exclusion is duplication activities.
Sounds straightforward and don't charge for the same thing twice.
Pretty much. If the subsidiary already has its own capable team doing a certain task, maybe they have a full local HR department, then the parent company can't really charge them for duplicative global HR oversight or services they don't actually need or use. It just duplicates effort and cost.
Got it. No shareholder cost, no duplicated effort. So, assuming we have a clean pool of costs related to valuable services, how do we get to the final price? What's the formula?
The standard approach, the one you see pretty much everywhere, is total cost plus an appropriate markup based on transfer pricing principles.
Okay, let's unpack total cost. What goes into that?
We usually break it down into three buckets. First, direct costs. This is mainly personnel costs, salaries, bonuses, related benefits for the people actually doing the work.
Clear enough.
Second, indirect costs. This is the overhead. Think about allocating a fair share of the supporting department's costs, like rent for their office space, communication bills, IT support for them, general admin costs.
The necessary background costs.
Exactly. And third, actual expenses. These are specific direct costs incurred for that service, like if someone had to travel, the flight, the hotel, those specific out-of-pocket costs.
Right. Direct, indirect, and actual expenses make up the total cost. Now, the really critical bit, the markup. How do we figure out what's appropriate?
Well, the default, technically, is always a benchmark analysis. You look for data on what independent companies charge for similar services to justify your markup percentage.
Which sounds like a lot of work.
It can be. But thankfully, there's a major simplification for certain types of services. This is the concept of low-value-adding services, or LVAS.
Ah, yes, the LVAS simplification. This is for the routine stuff.
Exactly. For your standard back-office support functions, think basic IT help desk, routine accounting tasks, general HR admin services that are supportive but not, you know, core value drivers.
So what's the simplification?
For services that genuinely qualify as LVAS, many jurisdictions align with OECD guidelines, and this includes key places like Japan and Malaysia, mentioned in our source materials, allow you to use a simplified 5% markup on the total cost.
Just a flat 5%.
Flat 5%, yes. It avoids the need for a complex benchmark study for these specific low-risk services. But, and this is important, you always need to check if the specific country you're dealing with has officially adopted this 5% safe harbor. It's common, but not universal.
That 5% is a huge practical help. But what about the other extreme? Our sources seemed quite concerned about companies charging no markup at all.
Yeah, that's a big red flag. Trying to charge just the total cost with zero markup, or only charging for the actual travel expenses, or even charging nothing. These are all really risky from a transfer pricing perspective.
But don't some guidelines mention situations where just cost might be okay?
There's some language about tax authorities potentially considering cost-only charges for services that are purely incidental to another main transaction. But the sources we reviewed strongly warn against interpreting that as a green light for zero markup on regular IGS.
So the takeaway is, arm's length usually means cost plus some profit.
Pretty much, unless you have extremely specific documented reasons and local guidance says otherwise, zero markup is asking for scrutiny.
Okay, so we have the price. Total cost plus markup. Now, how do companies actually operate this? How do they manage the internal charging process? Seems like there are two main ways people do this, setting aside rare cases where you have a perfect third-party price comparison.
Correct. Two dominant operational models, and they carry very different risk profiles. The first one is Method A, the direct charge approach, often implemented using a day rate or hour rate.
Right, the per-day charging model. How does that work mechanically?
You basically calculate the total annual cost for a person doing a certain job role, including their direct salary costs and their share of the indirect overheads. Then you divide that by the number of working days you expect in a year, maybe 240 days, something like that.
Okay, so you get a cost per day.
Exactly. Then you add your appropriate markup, maybe the 5% for LVAS or a benchmarked rate. This gives you a rate per day or per hour. Our sources had an example, something like $46,000 a day for a general manager level based on their specific costs and a 6% markup used in that instance.
And the advantage here seems obvious. Clarity.
Huge advantage. With this method, the service provider logs their time. I spent 2 days working on the marketing plan for subsidiary B. You multiply the days by the rate. It clearly links the costs, the time spent, and who benefited.
So less room for argument during an audit.
Generally, yes. Provided that underlying day rate calculation is solid and documented, Method A is considered much lower risk. The connection between the charge and the service received is very direct.
Okay, that sounds like the preferred route, which leads us to the alternative, the one that apparently causes more issues. Method B, the indirect charge or cost allocation model.
Right. This is where things often get contentious. With Method B, you take the total costs plus markup for an entire shared department, let's say, the central IT department or the corporate management team.
You pool all their costs together.
Exactly. You pool it all into one big pot, and then you allocate that total amount out to the various subsidiaries, A, B, C, etc., using some kind of allocation key.
And the key could be anything.
It could be based on the number of employees each subsidiary has, or their percentage of total group sales, maybe the value of assets they hold. Various metrics are used.
And you flag this as high risk. Why? Where's the danger?
The number one audit risk here is the rationality and reasonableness of that allocation key. Is the chosen key actually a sensible way to measure how much benefit each subsidiary received from that pool of costs?
Can you give an example of where it goes wrong?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
A classic problem area, highlighted in our sources too, is allocating all central management costs based only on each subsidiary's sales revenue.
Why is that bad?
Well, think about it. Does the amount of HR support a subsidiary needs really correlate directly with its sales figures? Or IT support? Probably not directly, or at least not for all the costs in that pool. If the link between the cost driver, what causes the cost, and the allocation key, how you split it, is weak or illogical,
then the tax authority can challenge it.
They can, and they do. They might argue that the allocation is arbitrary and doesn't reflect actual service consumption, and then they can potentially disallow a large chunk of the expense the subsidiary tried to claim. We're talking potentially losing the tax deduction for that cost.
Wow. So if a company has to use allocation for some shared costs, what's the best way to minimize that risk?
The key is to be as specific as possible for as long as possible. First, try to directly charge any costs you can link specifically. If someone in the central team spent a week working only for subsidiary A, charge that time directly using method A if possible.
Okay, so minimize the size of the pool that needs allocating.
Precisely. Reduce the amount in the pot. And then, for the costs that genuinely are shared and need allocation, don't just use one single key for everything. Look at the different types of costs within that pool.
Ah, so different keys for different costs.
Ideally, yes. Maybe IT infrastructure costs are allocated based on user headcount, while certain financial management costs are allocated based on asset value, for instance. You need to review it line by line and make sure the key used for each category of expense makes logical sense. Don't just apply sales revenue across the board to everything.
That makes a lot of sense. Be granular, be logical. Okay, this distinction between direct charging and allocation is critical. Let's move to the final section. Common pitfalls. Even if you have the structure right, what are the ongoing management mistakes people make that cause problems later, especially in an audit?
Yeah, there are definitely recurring issues. Our sources flag four key areas to watch out for. First, handling outsourced or pass-through costs.
Meaning costs paid to external vendors.
Exactly. If the parent company hires an external consultant to do some work for a subsidiary, you need to determine. Is the parent company simply acting as a paying agent, just passing the costs through with no markup? Or did the parent add value, maybe coordinating the work, taking on risk, providing expertise alongside the consultant?
And if they added value,
then a markup on the external costs might be appropriate. But if it's a pure pass-through, usually no markup is applied to that specific external cost. The definition of what counts as a simple pass-through can vary by country. Singapore and Malaysia were mentioned as examples with specific rules, so you need to check locally.
Okay, watch the pass-throughs. What's the second pitfall?
Costs recovered elsewhere. This is about double dipping. You have to be really careful not to charge for the same cost twice through different mechanisms.
Like how?
A common example is advertising. If the group's royalty structure already includes a component that compensates the parent for central advertising and brand building efforts, then those same advertising costs cannot also be included in the IGS cost pool and charged out again.
Right. Check, you're not asking for the money twice. What's number three?
Frequency of review. This is about keeping things up to date. Often, those IGS day rates, or the total cost pools for allocation, are based on the previous year's actual costs, or maybe on the current year's budget.
That seems reasonable initially.
It is, but costs change. If actual costs during the year end up being significantly different from the budget or prior year figures used for the rate, you need to review and potentially adjust. Or if there are major changes in personnel costs, maybe a big company-wide salary increase, as one source put it, that can make your old rates inaccurate very quickly.
So stale rates are a risk. You need regular check-ins.
Definitely. You need to ensure the price remains arm's length based on the current reality, not just historical data.
And the final pitfall. This one sounded a bit technical.
It's about recouping IGS via other transactions. Sometimes, for cash flow simplicity, companies might want to offset payments. Like, subsidiary A owes parent co for IGS, and parent co owes subsidiary A for something else, so they net the payments.
That sounds okay, just managing cash.
Offsetting the payment itself, see you in Japanese, one source noted, is generally acceptable. The problem arises if you try to build the IGS price into the price of a different transaction. For example, deciding not to charge IGS separately, but instead just increasing the price of products sold from parent to subsidiary A to cover the IGS cost.
Ah, so you're burying the IGS charge inside another price.
Exactly. Trying to combine the IGS price into the price setting of goods or royalties is generally discouraged or not permitted in principle. You must calculate and document the IGS price separately, even if you net off the final payment amounts. The transparency of the service charge is key.
That's a crucial distinction. Don't hide the service charge within another transaction's price. Okay, this has been incredibly helpful, really clarifying a complex area.
It's definitely dense, but vital for multinationals.
So to quickly recap for you, the listener, Intragroup services need clear commercial value for the recipient. The basic formula is total cost plus an appropriate markup. Often the 5% simplified rate works for those low value add back office tasks.
And operationally, the direct charge method using day rates is much safer, providing a clear link.
While the indirect cost allocation method is under intense scrutiny, especially the logic behind those allocation keys, you really need to justify those line by line.
And remember, tax authorities know this can be a weaker area in compliance for many companies. They often target IGS because, well, as one source put it, they can easily point out issues if the documentation and logic aren't robust.
Diligent management isn't just best practice, it's essential defense.
Absolutely.
So, wrapping up with a final thought for you to take away. We've talked a lot about getting the markup right, but maybe the most critical defense in an audit starts even earlier. It's about proving the legitimacy of that base cost pool, the BHA. Ensuring every single line item in there genuinely represents a service with commercial value and doesn't hide shareholder costs or duplicated efforts.
The foundation has to be solid.
Exactly. So the provocative question for you is this. Thinking about your own organization, or one you know well, what specific expense lines currently sitting in your general ledger, perhaps allocated out as overhead, would be the hardest to defend? Which ones would struggle most under that strict commercial value for the subsidiary test? Mulling that over might reveal where your biggest IGS risks really lie.